According to UMKC students working to feed Kansas City's hungry, 40% of food in the U.S. ends up becoming what we call food waste. The wilted bag of spinach that gets tossed. The leftovers on your plate at a restaurant when a server clears your table. That's 40% of all food. At the same time, 1 in 6 people go to bed hungry. That's the lopsided equation that the students were trying to resolve when they started a project called Feed KC, and the work they've done through that project just earned them a ticket to London, where they took part in a global conference about how to make a difference within your community. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to hear a little about what those students are doing here in town and what they learned in London. Andrea Savage, project manager of Feed KC, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Explain Feed KC.
So Feed KC originally started addressing just that need. It was clear to us that food insecurity was not a production issue, but a distribution issue. And so we started by assessing the needs within our own most immediate community, so the UMKC cafeteria. And we saw that tons of edible food was getting thrown away, literally tons. And so we started by redistributing that food by ourselves.
Wait, can you describe that in a little more detail? I'm picturing people on bikes, delivering food. Is that what did it actually look like?
No. So what we did was we would go to the cafeteria on a weekly basis on a Saturday morning. We'd walk in. They would have large industrial trays full of food for us to load up into the back of our cars. And then we would drive over and deliver it to different soup kitchens across the area. So through that, we've done 1.5 tons of food, which is approximately 3,500 meals.
And what state of preparedness are the foods that you're picking up? Is it mostly ingredients that didn't get used or what?
So it's a little bit of everything. For the most part, though, we specialize in prepared foods. So it's food that they prepared to go out onto the cafe line, but it never got there and that they don't want to use for the next week. So usually before large breaks in the semester, Christmas break or spring break or something like that, then we'll get some more of the ingredient type stuff that won't last up until the when school resumes.
So how long has this been going on?
Been going on for almost 2 years now.
That's so exciting. What have you learned just by inserting yourself into this process of food distribution within our community?
One of the main things I've learned is that it occurs everywhere, but a lot of people aren't aware of it. So even when we were going out and interviewing different restaurants and talking to people outside of UMKC cafeteria, sometimes people were like, oh, I don't think we waste food. And then they'd come back and say, actually, we just realized, we are wasting food daily. Food waste is something that becomes so automatic for so many people, they kind of don't even realize they do it anymore.
So just by inserting yourself into a conversation about it, that seems to be a step.
Yeah, definitely raising awareness.
How did the whole trip to London thing come about? It was the culmination of a long-term competition, if I understand right, and only a select group of projects made it that far.
Yes. So the business pitch competition was started by Unilever sometime earlier last year. And it started with 58,000 individuals who applied, and this was the top 81 in the nation. So UMKC and Actis, that's who we went with, did not apply for the competition. We were actually selected to go. So Unilever is a longtime sponsor of Enactus, and the Feed KC project is a partner of, was created under UMKC and Actis. And so we had won a grant from Unilever about this time last year, because they had sent out a challenge of who could work on food insecurity and food waste and a couple of other things. And we were number one in the nation for our solution to food waste.
What do you think set your solution apart? Because what you've just described is fairly straightforward, taking waste from one institution and then delivering it to other institutions. Is that really something that other people aren't doing? Or was there something about your particular execution of it that was different?
Yeah, so part of the next phase of the project is that we're working to develop a mobile application that'll instantly connect those businesses with excess food to the kitchens who need it. So that was the part of the solution that made it a little bit more innovative, that they looked and said, oh, that's the extra step, because there are some businesses right now that, yeah, they do donate food on a regular basis. So
when you got to London, so you got to go to London as part of this group, and there were other groups trying to solve the same kinds of problems in their own communities, right?
No,
or
so
different kinds of problems.
The challenges that we were set to solve were business challenges within Unilever. So Unilever really pushes having their brands, having their products have purpose and a social purpose. And so because of our background in social entrepreneurship, that's why we were invited. And so we were doing a specific pitch for a Unilever brand and how their brand could make a greater impact on the community.
It is so interesting to think about something like addressing hunger and food waste as a business proposition. And I am really intrigued by that.
Yeah. So the specific competition and the specific goal of UMKC and Actis is to create entrepreneurial solutions to issues within the community. And so that's kind of how it became more into a business setting as opposed to just a project.
So when you got to London, there were two challenges. You were competing with people worldwide. How did it go? How did you do?
Yeah, so I frequently described it as probably the least competitive competition I've ever been to. We got to meet with students from 28 different countries. And so we made tons of connections. We got to hear from the CEO of Unilever, the CFO. So that in and of itself was kind of the prize. We didn't win. We were semifinalists, but we didn't win the overall competition. But all of that other stuff that we got to do in addition to the competition were kind of this is the most amazing part of this competition.
So the people who you were competing and also like not in a competitive spirit exactly, against. But where else were people from? Who did you meet? What kinds of challenges are they working to solve in their communities?
Yeah, so people got to the competition through several different means. So there was, of course, people who had gone through the traditional, the 58,000 narrowed down to the 81. There were people who had gone through that. There were college students who were also employees of Unilever. There were people who had competed in something called a hackathon. So that's Unilever issues a challenge. And it's not like a computer hackathon like we think of it, but they issue a challenge and then students have 48 hours to come up with a solution.
Like life hacks.
Yeah, like a life hackathon.
So
from countries, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, the UK, of course, Italy, just all over.
Was it illuminating for you to see how people in other parts of the world approach problem solving? Or is that something that's more of like a universal language? Or is it more of like a, whoa, I mean, I'm meeting people who approach problem solving itself in really different ways?
Yeah, so I really enjoyed getting to see the other team's presentations and less of a how they approach problem solving, but how they made the problem adapt to fit their unique communities. So, you know, like the team from Bangladesh used a focus that was more child-centric because in their preliminary research, they discovered that adults weren't really willing to change their ways. Or like in the team from Indonesia, they had a more technology perspective. And it was very interesting to see how each team came up with their different solutions that fit the country that they were from.
Did you hear something from someone else, like someone who is coming from a background where what they work on in their day-to-day life is different from you, where they live and the community where they're working is different from Kansas City, but the way that they approached something gave you maybe some ideas about, oh, this is something I could try in Kansas City on the project I'm working on?
I don't know of a specific example off the top of my head, but definitely was illuminating from a, I just didn't realize how other cultures function or work to that level. So specifically, we were fairly close to the teams from Pakistan and from Bangladesh. And so just learning, even just they dress differently at work, and that affects different things. And the structure of the office, they showed us pictures of the interior of their office. And it was something that we're kind of just now getting to in the United States is that open office floor plan. But this is just something they've always had and more collaborative.
Andrea, stay with me through the break, okay?
All right, thanks.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll bring in the faculty advisor who works with this group to provide some background and talk about the potential of students to have an impact. I'm Gina Kaufman. If you've ever had that experience of seeing how people in other places approach innovations and problem solving in their communities and had your eyes really opened, call in. Tell the story. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been hearing from a student who just returned from London, where she and her peers took on a challenge based on the work that they've been doing around hunger on UMKC's campus. And they presented before global audiences. The project is Feed KC, and it grew out of a group called Enactus. The faculty sponsor for that group is with us now. Ben Williams teaches in the Block School of Business. And Ben, good morning.
Good morning.
So how long have you been an advisor to the UMKC chapter of this group, Enactus?
I've been there about 5 or 6 years now.
What are some of the other kinds of projects that they've taken on in the past?
That's a great question. There are a lot of projects that happen through UMKC Enactus every year. In general, they're taking on about 12 different projects each year. And this could be everything from small little projects that might be, you know, something that's done in a month or so to our larger projects, like Andrea's Feed KC project. Right now, one of the other big projects they've got going on is a project in Agwoku, Nigeria. So one of our staff members at UMKC identified a school he went to when he was younger. He went back to visit recently and found that nothing had really been done to the school since he left 20 or 30 years ago, and came to the Enactus team and just said, hey, this is not good for the students. It hurts the community. This community can't thrive without a functioning school. So what can you do to help? And so far they've taken this school from, you know, a school with crumbling buildings, no running water, no bathroom facilities, to now they've got a school with a well, with bathroom facilities. They've increased the student attendance. They've increased the amount of teachers involved. So that's another great example of what they're doing and when they're doing this year. You know, I could talk for days about all the projects they've been doing over the last few years.
It is interesting to me, and I've touched on this, but the organization behind this global competition, like you, it seems, you're coming from a business standpoint in sort of shepherding this group, Enactus, that you see what often gets classified as perhaps volunteerism or mm-hmm. community service as innovation and entrepreneurship. Like, can you talk to me a little about that particular lens on, yeah, what historically has been seen as community service?
Sure. So I think Enactus and Andrew's a great example of this. Students these days see themselves as part of a larger world and see their role in that world as more than just them getting a job and you know, taking care of themselves. They want to be part of something bigger. And Enactus has taken that idea of sort of social impact that you're right, used to be very much focused on let's go volunteer, let's go, you know, pick up trash on the side of the road, that sort of thing. And we've moved it to how do we have a sustainable impact for the long term? How can we do something that's impact is going to be felt beyond the time that we're actually doing it?
So it's about systems rather than like task fulfillment.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So what they do is identify needs in the community, and then they do a lot of research into that need. They use human-centered design to go out there and see what's actually happening. Who's
involved? What is human-centered design?
Yeah, so human-centered design is a way to look at the world and look at problems in a more holistic sense. So you go out there and observe the actual issue. You talk to those people involved. And you create a solution with the actors that are involved in that. So with Feed KC, Andrea went out there and worked with shelters in the area. She worked with the head chef at the UMKC cafeteria. She worked with other people in the community that allowed her to get a better understanding of the need as a whole and create a solution that is actually sustainable, because you don't want to create something and come back and find out there's, well, you know, we're moving food, but you know what? Shelters don't want that type of food. Well, all of our effort would have been in vain if we didn't reach out to them first. So this is an entrepreneurial lens we use to better understand the needs that they're trying to tackle.
A lot of people, I think, can hear the word entrepreneurship as a sort of synonym for starting your own business. Right. And it sounds like that is not the definition you're working with.
No. And in fact, beyond my role with Enactus, I teach in the Department of Entrepreneurship at the Block School of Management and work in the Rainier Institute. And we look at entrepreneurship holistically. These are a set of skills, a mindset that people have. We look at everyone as an entrepreneur. It's just a sense of how much of an entrepreneur they are. How trained are they as an entrepreneur? And you can apply that mindset to a for-profit business, a nonprofit organization. You can apply it to your daily life or maybe your career inside a larger organization. The skill sets and mindset are the same. It's just a way you apply those. And you're right. You know, applying those to starting a business is a great thing to do, but so is starting an organization like Feed KC.
I am also interested in this idea of students who are not yet in the position of getting certain like job titles out in the community, still having a way in if they want to have an impact right now on something like a crucial issue in our city. Is that part of the idea behind this too? Because
yeah,
I think it's easy for people to feel like not empowered at that stage in life.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I have the privilege of working with this Enactus team. They're an amazing group of students. Over 100 students from all over campus coming together to solve these needs. And it's actually funny because they have the skills, they have the abilities as a team to do these amazing projects. And it really just takes someone sort of lighting a fire and saying, you can go do this. And not only can you, but we expect you to go do this. So to be quite honest with you, they are better at running meetings and projects than a lot of the people we probably run into in the so-called real world, the working world. They do a fantastic job. But yeah, it's for me, my role is student development. So giving them these opportunities, encouraging them to go out there and try something new and sort of trying to create the systems and resources they need to be successful.
Andrea, jump back in here. Do you think that most students just generally, I mean, I'm not speaking about students in Enactus, I'm speaking just about students right now. Do you think people feel empowered in this way? Or do you think the idea that like, yes, I can go out and do something in the quote unquote real world, do you think that that is the general understanding?
I think it's definitely the general desire. I think it's hard sometimes for students to figure out, well, what medium do I do that through? What platform do I use? Things like that. So, students want to do it, and they have the ability to do it, but they don't always have the means by which to do it.
So, as globally, just having been in London with people from all over the world, what is your sense of the role of entrepreneurship in all of this? Like, because of, as we just talked about, that word often sounding so synonymous with starting your own business.
So I think Ben touched on it too, is that part of entrepreneurship is that human-centered design process. And it was interesting to see students present that in their case presentations in London, that they had done they'd followed the entrepreneurial process to create even just a marketing plan or a business pitch, that entrepreneurship can lace its way through multiple different practices and fields, that people who are biology majors need it, people who are all these other different majors need entrepreneurship and need that human-centered design to do well.
Andrea Savage, Ben Williams, with us from Enactus at UMKC. Thanks so much.
Thank you
for having us.
The project that they were talking about is Feed KC. I'm Gina Kaufman. When we return, it's all about taxidermy. Stay tuned. When people ask Chantel Walker what her parents do for a living, she kind of squirms. This is what she tells them.
Oh, my mom, she works in a bank. And then quietly, my dad's a taxidermist. They're like, a what? He drives a taxi? No, he doesn't drive a taxi. He mounts dead animals.
In case you couldn't make that out, Chantel's dad makes taxidermy. His name is Ken Walker, and if you follow taxidermy, that's a name you probably know already. He's won Best in World in the category of mammals, and Ken's personal quest to make a taxidermied Bigfoot is the focus of a new documentary about him called Big Fur. but the dignity and artistry of his craft, as well as the unusual home life of a taxidermy professional, are a huge part of the story.
This is my tiger that I won my first Best of Show with. I gave it to my daughter Chantel. It's a cat that died from epilepsy in the zoo. I also have a snow leopard over here that I got from the same zoo. This one died of old age, and I gave this to Patrick. This is Patrick's snow leopard. Each kid got a cat.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and the Kansas City filmmaker behind this documentary is with us now. Dan Wayne, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. Thanks.
Why did you want to make a movie about taxidermy?
Well, I always kind of had a fascination about taxidermy, and I started learning about it from books from the library, and then I found this forum online that was an amazing source of information, and it's called taxidermy.net, and I quickly learned that some of the best taxidermists in the world were on this forum, and I became more interested in the personalities than actually practicing, and I thought this would be a great subject for a documentary, and it's kind of something that stewed in my mind for a while, and I made a list of people I thought would be good because I thought it would have to be character-driven. And
oh, it is. What led you to Ken Walker?
Well, Ken is quite a character. And in the taxidermy world, he's pretty unique because he's known for recreations, which is endangered or extinct animals that are made out of other animal hides. And it requires a lot of different skill sets than regular taxidermy does because you have to do a lot of research and there's a lot of creativity involved. And you have to actually make the form and figure out what hide to use to make it realistic. And I knew he had a thing about Bigfoot, but I didn't know how much he was obsessed with Bigfoot. And when he told me he was going to make one, I realized, you know, that would be a great movie right there.
You talk to his admirers, and they are many. He is a big deal in the taxidermy world. One guy makes a comment that I love, which is that there are animals that look stuffed and animals that look like they're alive, and Ken's animals look alive. After spending, I mean, you spent years watching him, right?
Yeah.
I mean, after spending that much time talking to him, watching him at work, following what he does, do you have a sense of what makes that difference?
You know, I think that a lot of it is the expression he's able to put into the animals he mounts.
The expression. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with the eyes and the pose of the animal. You know, a lot of taxidermists typically will make their animals look ferocious, and Ken isn't as likely to do that. In fact, you know, he's gotten a lot of attention for some of his like very relaxed poses that he does. And it's something that's kind of hard to pinpoint. You know, you see an animal that is mounted really terribly, and there's plenty of those on the internet, and you know it, but it's hard to tell when something looks right, except that they do kind of look alive.
I want to share a clip from your movie. This is Ken Walker talking about the subtlety and what he's trying to achieve, which is like the life essence of a very specific animal, a very specific animal. Let's give that a quick listen.
There's a difference between a dog and a wolf. You know, a dog is, a wolf is like a, just don't move too quick, you know, they got that. That's what I have to do. I have to get the difference between a dog and a wolf, the difference between a person and a Sasquatch.
So, okay, we'll get to the difference between a person and a Sasquatch, but the difference between a dog and a wolf is a pretty profound thing, that the shape of two different animals can be that similar, dog versus wolf, but that something in its gait and in its eyes and in its...
Yeah, you know, you can't really, you know, that was, if you saw that clip, you would see what Ken does with his eyes. And, you know, a dog is more relaxed. A dog won't really look at you in the eyes, usually. But a wolf is more of a predator, you know, and they're on the lookout.
I'm staring you down.
Yeah, exactly. And there is that kind of tension. And that is something that is brought up several times in the movie is the importance of eyes in taxidermy, and it's really where people look immediately when they look into at a mount. And if the eyes are right, it helps a lot. And part of the movie, we go into the eyeball factory and actually watch them make the eyeballs for the Sasquatch, which is pretty cool.
Okay, so we're getting into this whole Sasquatch Bigfoot territory, and I don't want people to be left with like, but what are they talking about? So he wants to make a Bigfoot, aka Sasquatch, right?
Yeah, same thing.
And what's the deal behind that?
Well, Ken Ken has a tendency to really focus on these different things, and I've heard from other members of his family, he was really into dinosaurs for a while, and at one point he became really kind of obsessed with Bigfoot.
What about Bigfoot?
I think trying to prove that they're out there. He's a hunter. He lives in the foothills of the Rockies, the Canadian Rockies, and hunting up there is more of a way of life, and the wilderness up there is huge and vast. And when you're up there in the bush, as they say, it's not such a far stretch to imagine that there could be an animal up there that, if it's smart and has a good warm coat, it could evade humans. And I think, he's heard a lot of stories from hunters that he thinks are very credible. And the main thing that I come away with from that is that the hunters know the difference between a bear and something else. And that's a real common thing you hear them say when they've had a Sasquatch sighting is it was not a bear. I don't know what it was, but it was not a bear.
So this whole Bigfoot pursuit is part of this recreation idea in taxidermy. And I want to spend some time with you on that because it is a little bit controversial, right?
It sure is, yeah.
Can you explain that?
Well, there's different camps of people in this world. There are some that say, well, there's no such thing as Bigfoot because we would have found them by now. And then there's others that say, I know Bigfoot exists because I've seen it. And then there's the other people, and I kind of consider myself one of them, that it's like, well, it's a really cool idea. I hope they exist. It's a very romantic notion. The idea that there could still be a wild hominid living in the woods that we don't know is there is, kind of a humbling thing that where we really don't know everything. They constantly are finding new species. They're finding recently found a huge cave they didn't know existed in British Columbia. So, there are parts of the world that
there are things we still don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot of things we don't know.
But so for people, though, who see taxidermy in like what used to be called the stuffing of animals, and although you explain in the movie that the terminology to stuff is sort of like rudimentary, but the idea that this would be like a documentation of life in a way, this recreation idea of taxidermy gets away from that. That this isn't like the preservation of a form that I have witnessed and found.
Right.
This is something else. Can you explain what recreation is and how it works?
Well, Ken's known for his recreations, as I said, and he did an Irish elk, he did a saber-toothed tiger, and he did a giant panda. And these are things that, he really has to have an understanding of what they may have looked like. In the case of the panda, they still exist. It was a little bit different.
But I do want to talk to you about that story in some more detail. Go on.
But the Irish elk, he studied cave paintings and looked at, measured, fossilized bones that exist in different museums and then kind of used his knowledge as a hunter and all the things he knows about animals from, been mounting them for 30 or 40 years is that, he decided what their colors might look like. And there's just a lot of creativity in that. And and he says in the movie that it's a lot like taxidermy, but it's kind of like taxidermy in reverse because you make the form and then you make the hide to fit the form. Whereas in regular taxidermy, it's kind of the other way around. You've got the hide of the animal, and then you have to make the form to fit the hide so that it matches what the animal actually looked like.
So let's go into the example of the panda. He won best in world for this panda. He was like, was he commissioned by the Smithsonian or just congratulated by them? In the movie, there's this scene where he's like really touched by a call he gets from the Smithsonian after he wins. But this panda alarmed people because they thought perhaps it was real.
Yeah.
And you're not supposed to taxidermy a panda.
Well, theoretically, you can taxidermy a panda. You can't have possession of a panda without the right permits. But at the time he was working at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, he was brought in as a special team to redo the Hall of Mammals. And this was around the year 2000, kind of. And, one reason they brought him in as a Canadian, it was kind of a big deal because, it's an American institution, but he is, one of the best at carving forms when there is no form to go off of. You know, I mean, they had a lot of animals that were very unique, and he was a big help with that. And they actually had, I think the panda's name was Sing Sing that Nixon gave, or that the Chinese gave to Nixon, and was living in the National Zoo and had passed away. I can't remember why, but they had the animal preserved, I suppose, in like a barrel or something. And he wanted to mount it, and they said, no, it's too sensitive. You can't do that. So instead, he took measurements from the carcass, and I think he cast the hands, and he made his own out of black bears. And when he presented it, there were a lot of people that thought it was a real panda. And
black bears partly dyed white.
Yeah, yeah. Different phase. Black bears will be brown in certain phases, and he did bleach them. And he's actually done a few more pandas that way since then, and has gotten very, very good at it. Although that first one was good, and it made a big splash when he brought it in, because everybody thought it was a real panda.
And so that gets at this whole idea of recreation, though, being its own separate art form.
Yeah, it's a pretty unique subgroup of taxidermy. You know, a lot of taxidermists specialize in mammals or birds or fish, and very few actually do recreations. And a lot of them are birds that are, you know, like a bald eagle that's done out of, you know, different feathers that they dye and things like that.
I was intrigued that Ken Walker came from a background in claymation.
Yeah, well, you know, he told me early on that he used to make these little films with his friend. And man, I tried hard to find that footage, but it just somehow got lost. You know, these Super 8 films, it would have been cool to have. But yeah, and it's you know, before he mounts any animal, he makes what he calls a sketch, a 3D sketch, and he does it out of plasticine, this little like thing of clay. And it's amazing. He'll be talking to you, and all of a sudden, there's a bear that looks like a perfect bear, but, you know, it's 3 inches long. And, you know, he did that in the movie with the Sasquatch, and, you know, I show part of that as the part of the process.
So as far as, though, the art of taxidermy, this is part of what I feel like you're getting at. You seem to be making a pretty strong argument about taxidermy, that it sometimes defies the stereotype that exists around it. Like when I think about this guy coming up through having worked in claymation, like it seems to me trying to make a case for this as an art, period.
Yeah, I think it is. You know, I mean, it's not all taxidermy is art. And one thing that interests me and always has, one reason I was drawn to taxidermy is that it's good taxidermy is a combination of that art and craft. And in this case, also science. So it's, to me, I find it really intriguing. But I do hope the movie does present it as a legitimate art form and helps to kind of break that stereotype that I know a lot of taxidermists struggle with, especially the ones that are kind of my age or older.
Did you, when you were talking to people for this movie, did you hear a lot about feeling sort of stigmatized in the world of like creative people?
Yeah, totally. A lot of taxidermists don't think they're taken seriously as artists. And there's always this kind of cloud of the image of Norman Bates that hangs over their head. I heard it over and over again. And so that kind of plays into the movie in what I hope is kind of a funny way. But it is something that they struggle with.
What do you think is sort of a moment in the creative process for a taxidermist that a lot of just lay people who maybe have like walked into a store that has a mounted deer and, you know, like that's their familiarity with this, that they don't appreciate?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question.
When you think about the process that taxidermists work through, was there something that surprised you?
Well, it did as I started learning about it. You know, a lot of people don't have any clue. They think that, you know, they just don't know what's underneath that hide, you know, and the truth is it's usually a polyurethane form. A lot of taxidermists just buy it from a manufacturer, but people like Ken carve their own. And there's a lot that goes into that, you know, from the little parts like the mouth parts, if they're open mouth, or the ears, which are incredibly hard to do.
What is hard about an ear?
Well, they tear easily. You have to get everything out of there, and then you have to make a form that fits in there. And Ken likes to use Bondo. Some people use a store-bought form, and it just depends what animal you're doing. But it's a really tricky thing to make the ears look right. You know, to me, the face is the hard part. You know, the eyes and the ears and the nose.
You show there's this aspect of like setting the eyes is what it's called, mm-hmm. where there's a tool, and I don't know what it's called, but you see taxidermists in this movie kind of gently sculpting that edge of the eyelid around the eye so it falls just right.
Yeah.
That creeped me out. I had to close my eyes because, like, my eyes hurt looking at that tool skimming the eyeball.
Well, it's not as bad as a Man Ray film. But, yeah, it doesn't to me because I know it's a glass eye.
Right. I mean, I know it, but I guess this does get at these fine details of sculpting.
Yeah. The eyes are really an important part. And they use, you know, in that case, the tool I think you're referring to was a clay modeling tool. So, you know, taxidermists are pretty resourceful people and they'll use all kinds of tools for all kinds of things. But they do use a lot of modeling tools it's a lot of them make their own tools too.
So talk to me again about Bigfoot. I just, like, does Bigfoot kind of represent a larger idea to Ken Walker, to you?
Well, I think for me it certainly does. For Ken, I think you'd have to ask him. I wouldn't want to speak for him. But, you know, before I met Ken, I had never thought twice about Bigfoot. It was just, I just never occurred to me. You know, I think maybe living in Kansas City, you're less likely to think about it than if you live in the bush up in Canada, but
where it is rumored to roam.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are sightings everywhere, so it's kind of hard to say, but
has there been one in Kansas City?
There's been some in Lee's Summit.
What?
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Well, I don't know a whole lot about
that. Okay, but there have been sightings.
I didn't dig too deep into that. It's kind of a lot of people think the movie's about Bigfoot, and it is in a way. But to me, the Bigfoot it stands for, in more of a mythical sense, of wilderness. And, you know, a lot of Bigfooters is what I call them, and I met a lot of them, and including some of the most famous ones while I was making the movie. And, you know, they all want to protect Bigfoot environment. And what struck me as kind of ironic is that, well, Bigfoot, if they do exist, they share this environment with a lot of other animals that are at least as important as Bigfoot. You know, woodland
caribou.
That
we know exist.
Sure.
For sure.
Or, you know, some that we know they exist, but they're very elusive, like wolverines. Nobody ever sees a wolverine in the wilderness, you know. But they have the same habitat. So to me, it kind of represents the value of the wild. And if we can't imagine, you know, and there's a great character, Bob Pyle, in the movie who comes right out and says this, you know, if we can't look into the wilderness because it's become so tame that we can't even imagine that there's a big hairy monster in there, then we've lost something a lot more profound than Bigfoot.
I mean, I agree with you that the wilderness and its existence is profound, but why do you think that is?
Well, there's a long history in all cultures of wild man of the woods, you know, the boogeyman, you know, and don't go out into the woods alone because the boogeyman will get you. And, you know, maybe there's some truth to that. Maybe it's just something parents made up to keep their kids from roaming too far and getting lost. But I think it's something, I think that we need that, you know, we need
there's something bigger than us.
Yeah. These stories that go beyond the campfire.
So when you set about making Bigfoot in an educated and informed way, as Ken Walker would need to do, because he has this whole methodology. So like with the Irish elk, I believe, you know, you're talking about he studied cave paintings. What does one study to construct the form of a Bigfoot?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Gina, because that is an important part of the film, too. Now, there's a lot of eyewitness accounts of Bigfoot, but there's one piece of so-called evidence that is considered the holy grail by all Bigfooters, and that's what's called the Patterson-Gimlin film. And this was shot in 1967 by two cowboys that were out trying to make a movie about Bigfoot in Northern California in a very remote area. And they saw a Bigfoot and they filmed it with a 16-millimeter camera, and it was shaky and most people laughed at it. But later on, and I don't know when this happened, probably in the 90s, late 90s, somebody digitized that film and stabilized it. And when that happened, you really could see detail that you couldn't see in the original film. And according to people like Ken, the movements of that animal were not human. The way it walked, the proportions of its limbs and upper limbs and lower limbs, and And apparently, according to a lot of experts, the technology to make a Bigfoot suit, a monkey suit, wasn't advanced enough at that time to do something that looked that real. So that's really what he studied. And that film has been analyzed to death, and he extrapolated the measurements according to trees and how far they were away from the camera and the focal length of the lens. And it's been done by more people than just Ken. And that's what he used as his reference.
Do you think this, the commitment that it takes to do this project, to make a Bigfoot out of animal hides and creating a form and studying reference material from what is, by what you're calling Bigfooters' assessments, like the most reliable documentation that could be found, that is a level of commitment that is really pretty intense. When you talk to Ken Walker about Bigfoot, where do you sense that the passion was coming from?
Well, I think at one point when you say you're going to do something, you kind of, and everybody knows you're going to do it, you're a little more tied to actually completing it. And then when you've got this guy following you around for a few years with a camera, then you really do have to finish it. And it's hard for a guy that runs his own business like Ken, because he's, you know, he's always behind on, I mean, he's got so many mounts, he's, you know, hunters or whoever are waiting for, you know, he does a lot of work for museums too. And
no one was just bringing him this need for.
No, but I think a lot of people weren't surprised because they knew how much he liked it and that that was kind of right up his alley, you know, being good at recreations.
Do you, having seen the end result, like, do you feel moved by, like, looking at Ken Walker's Bigfoot?
You know, probably not as much as I do by watching other people's reaction when they see it. You know, people love when they see it. It's a pretty phenomenal thing, and everybody wants to take their photo with it. And it's quite a spectacle to see.
What do people tell you when they're getting their picture taken? Like, has anyone told you, like, here's why this matters to me, here's my relationship with the story of Bigfoot?
No, not me personally, but Ken has told me about a lot of stories people have told him after they've seen it, you know, that it, you know, people that have had their own sightings apparently are pretty blown away by it. And one of them is in the film.
You are coming from a background in still photography. And as we've kind of referenced in this movie, Big Fur, about Ken Walker making taxidermy, you do see all these little details in the craft of a taxidermist that are visually and sonically very rich. But I wonder if that is part of what drew you to taxidermy as a process to explore, is just the visual moments. Like, there is a student of his who is working on, it looks like maybe a squirrel.
Rabbit.
Rabbit. You know what I'm talking about. Where she's blow-drying the fur and using a drill on what would be its stomach, but it's not, because it's not alive, but it does look so lifelike that the visual of, like, the squirrel's hair blowing and the stomach getting drilled, it's like, it takes a minute to get used to it. And it seems like someone with a photographer's background would gravitate toward that.
Sure, sure. I imagine that's why I was drawn to it in the very first place. You know, it's something that you look twice at almost always. I went to an exhibit at the Block Art Space, it's probably 9 years ago or 8 years ago, that had what's called rogue taxidermy, which is kind of a newer form of taxidermy that up until recently wasn't even really recognized by traditional taxidermists. But these people will make animals that are kind of imaginary out of different animals. They'll put wings on a squirrel or whatever. And when I saw that, you know, I already had this interest in taxidermy. I'd collected some at garage sales and things. And when I saw that, that's what really kind of kicked it in. It's like, this is something I should do. You know, I find it incredibly interesting, and it kind of plays tricks on your mind when you see it, especially when it's done well.
Do you, like, as taxidermy also enters the world of sort of like hipster phenomena, do you, going into a world of people who really have dedicated their lives to it and in many cases come from communities where taxidermy is part of the culture, you're talking about hunting communities, do you see there being kind of like different worlds of taxidermy at this point, or is it one world that's just getting broader and more open?
It's a little bit of both. You know, I think as the newer kind of hipster taxidermists are coming up, and they represent a different kind of demographic of people. And it's fascinating. One of the first introductions I had to this real world was going to the World Taxidermy Championships. And you see these people that are from, you know, potentially different ideological and political backgrounds that get together for this art, and they all seem to get along really well. It's a very diverse group of people.
That's pretty inspiring in a way, and maybe like surprising that one of the places where people can come together is around what often gets dismissed as, you know, dead animals.
Well, I think in this case, a lot of taxidermists are somewhat social outcasts and loners. A lot of them work alone, and a lot of them struggle with that kind of stigma and stereotype. And so when they do get together, you can feel the bond between them, you know, that they get to talk to somebody about things that they normally don't get to talk about with their friends or family.
Do you come away from making this movie a changed person in any way? I mean, you've taken years of your life to immerse yourself in a world that you mostly knew through garage sales before, if I'm hearing you right.
Yeah, I certainly have. I think any project of this scale is going to change you in some way. You know, I've met a lot of people that I've become friends with that I wouldn't normally, you know, hang out with. And, you know, I'm leaving tomorrow to go to the World Taxidermy Championships in Springfield. And I'm excited.
And that's where your film is going to premiere.
Yeah, it is on Thursday night. And I'm excited to see these people that, you know, normally I would have never had any relationship with. And now I walk in there and it's like a family reunion in a way.
The choice to do the premiere of your film at the World Taxidermy Championships says a lot about maybe like who you're making it for.
Yeah, I sure hope they like it. So far they do.
But not all documentary artists, like in whatever medium, are doing it for the subject. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, you know, you hang out with those people long enough and you kind of develop a relationship, a bond with them. I came on the heels of another BBC documentary when I started that had come out maybe a year or two before. And it was it didn't take a nice look at the taxidermists. I thought a lot of them felt like they were kind of tricked. And so a lot of people were a little bit skeptical of me at first. I'm not sure exactly how I earned their trust, but part of it was just, you know, I was a friend of Ken Walker, and he's like one of the stars of that world. And so people gave me good access.
And maybe you stuck around long enough that they could tell you weren't just doing a superficial job.
Well, and I think just being a one-man crew is different. You know, you're not looked at as critically as if you come in there with, you know, a bunch of people dressed in all black with really expensive equipment.
And you're working on another project coming up that kind of deals in, you went taxidermy project to taxidermy project, but now it seems like Bigfoot to disputed life forms, perhaps?
Well, you're talking about the next project?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not sure yet. My associate producer, Mark Gardner, wrote this brilliant story about the last Sasquatch. And so I've optioned that, and we're kind of working together to see where we can get it to go. I don't know that I'll actually, I doubt I'll be, you know, the director of it, but I'm going to try to get it going somehow. And then I've got some other documentary projects that aren't Bigfoot or taxidermy related that I'm looking into also.
But so can you just give a little hint about what people might learn about Sasquatch?
In my movie?
In the upcoming maybe project.
Well, it's a great story that would be it's so epic that it would be a series or a three season episodic kind of narrative structure. And it's about, you know, and one thing that a lot of people argue about the existence of Bigfoot is there would have to be so many that there's a genetic diversity. And in this case, there's only a few left, and they realize that they're dying out. And that's kind of the story in a nutshell.
The last of the Sasquatch. Well, and speaking of which, Ken Walker is bringing his Bigfoot to the Kansas City screening of Bigfoot.
Right. That'll be Sunday, May 5th at 5:30 at Screenland Armor.
Dan Wayne, thank you so much.
Thanks, Gina. It was a pleasure.
And as Dan said, that screening will be at Screenland Armor on May 5th. There's more information on the Screenland website. That's a wrap for today's show. Today's conversations will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. In addition to Big Fur, we talked about students trying to address hunger using the skills of entrepreneurship. Both discussions will be there. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, tune in for some reflections on whether the whole local sustainable trend in food is really sustainable economically. That's tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.